Welcome to Planning Commission meeting for October 10th, 2023. First, let's start with any public comments. Seeing none, we'll move to item number three, the work session on the draft code amendments. Sherry.
I forgot to test this. I don't know, like, both her and my new code enforcement person have COVID, so I have them both out this whole week. So, and then I have two people on vacation, so it's just three of us, and a fill-in building inspector from the consultant. So, but they missed we were working on the HVAC, so it's not cold in here, so we should be glad, because it was like 64 degrees this morning in the building, because they hadn't finished the glycol replacement. So anyway, it's working now, so we're not cold. We do have a leak in the council conference room though, so that's not good. Okay, so for you tonight, I have two chapters, chapter 6 and chapter 7 drafted. The first chapter is PUDs, condominium subdivisions, and recreation, mobile home or recreational vehicle parks, or those types of subdivisions. So most of the language is already in existence in our various areas of our zoning ordinance right now, but I'll just briefly go over each section, and if you have corrections or comments or questions, just stop me as we go along and we can address them. And I'll make sure I get your notes down for anything. So the first three sections of section 10 for PUDs are just basically your purpose statements for why we have PUDs, you know, basically to consolidate open space and cluster dwelling units. Section D, it establishes the process for the review and approval of PUDs, basically saying they're approved and reviewed exactly the same way as a regular subdivision is. What's different in a PUD from a regular subdivision is the standards of design. So it can be lot sizes, height, frontage requirements, those types of things are the things that we vary in PUDs. So section E is deviation from design standards. And so this is the big part where PUDs, what a PUD does. And I wanna just turn my page to that so I can. Section E is the section that I'm on page 2 and of the draft document that I gave you. And so, Section E, okay, I'm going to kind of back up for just a second. So when you get into the next sections, down in section 8, or H, excuse me, section H, it goes through the different various designs that you can vary as part of a PUD, that the Planning Commission will have the authority to vary. Anything else that they want, that an applicant wants varied, is considered a legislative change, and so that part would have to be reviewed by the City Council. So section E talks about any other deviation besides the ones that are outlined in the PUD chapter or the PUD section, and how they would go through that process. So they would first have to apply for a modification. So let's say some examples of this would be if our dead end street said the maximum length of a dead end street is 1,000 feet, and they wanted to go 1,200 feet. So they would apply for a modification. Under the previous existing language, they call it a variance, which is an incorrect term, because a variance would be something that would go to the hearing officer and would be requested to guarantee a property right. So kind of a equity kind of thing, that if I don't give them this variance, they won't have any property rights. So the hearing officer would give them a variance. This is actually a request for a modification in design standards. And so that would be a legislative change. And so that would go through the Planning Commission for a public hearing and recommendation to the City Council. The City Council would approve it. So the process would be like, would be that. And the Planning Commission could, if you had a preliminary plat in front of you that required a modification approval by the City Council, you could choose to table action on that preliminary plat until the modification was either approved or denied by the City Council, depending on the type of change it was, how important you thought it was to the overall design, or you would have the option to forward to conditionally approve the preliminary plat subject to them getting approval of the modification by the City Council. So I've written that into the section. Let's see. So some other examples would be like the maximum slope of a street. Right now, we only allow streets that are maximum slope of 12%. If somebody wanted to build a new street that was greater than 12%, they could go and make a case for that. That would not likely be something that we would approve. We don't even like to approve over 10%. If they wanted a change in the maximum density, that would also be a modification that would have to be approved by the City Council. Any questions on that section? Okay. Section M just talks about F talks about P districts and how PUD developments that are done in conjunction with a P district still require the rezone and the approval of a development agreement with the design standards and the deviations in that identified in the development agreement. So that would not be one that we have to apply for a specific modification, because it would be modified under the P district zoning. That would be where that legislative change would be made. Section G talks about just basically saying that the uses that are allowed in a PUD are the uses that are allowed in the underlying zone. We couldn't be in an R110 zone. They wanted to do a PUD and approve it to have triplexes or townhomes in it, because that's a use that's not allowed in the single family zone. They would have to have, they could get modifications to the lot size. Instead of having a 12,000 square foot lot, you might approve 8,000 square foot lots, and then open space that made up the overall density. But you couldn't change the uses or allow a hospital or a factory or something in that zone just because they did a PUD. You couldn't allow different uses in the zone, in the subdivision. And then it has a specific statement about the density that's allowed in the PUD determined by calculating the net developable area. So if we looked at a PUD on a specific property, we would look at how much area was taken by the road that they had to construct, and then we would look at the remaining area, the net area that was left before we calculated the density. They wouldn't get credit for the area where the road is going to be as part of their density calculation. Does that make sense? Okay. Oh, okay, I already covered those two. Okay, so Section H talks about the PUD standards, and these are the things that you can address as the Planning Commission when we're reviewing PUDs. Some of the requirements that I put in there, I have based on our experience and lessons learned in other developments. So, for instance, perimeter setback of 15 feet. Some of these townhomes that we've developed, the one up in the upper right-hand corner, that's the Vantage Point townhomes that are off of Orchard, down on the south end of Orchard Drive. And remember, that was an R M20, so they had 20 units to the acre. It was a standard subdivision as far as what their rights were. But we didn't have anything in place that said, hey, you have to set back these buildings so many feet from neighboring property owners. And so what I wanted to put in there was a perimeter setback for townhomes to be a minimum of 15 feet from the perimeter, and then increase that setback to 25 feet for structures that are over two stories. So if they did duplexes or townhomes that were two stories, they could be 15 feet away. If they wanted to do three-story buildings next to single-family homes, then it should be a setback of 25 feet. Just to, we've had those conversations with abutting property owners where they have three stories next to their single story, single family house and looking down into the yard. So that's a reaction to some of the developments we've done and lessons we've learned. The front street setback, set that as a minimum because we've had some that have been smaller and some that have been bigger. And I'll show you in the next slide ones that look a little better. I think that the one in the middle, that's Orchard Grove, and that one was a good demonstration of a nice setback from Orchard Drive. And as you remember, when we did that P district, we negotiated those setbacks, and that turned out a little nicer than some of the other projects that are closer to the street on this type of use. And then a front setback from the building. So when I'm talking about front, I'm talking about where the front door is. From a perimeter or a physical barrier like a retaining wall should be set back 25 feet. So if you look at the lower left-hand corner, that is in the ridge. And if you look at those two buildings on the right-hand side of that lower left picture, and then you see the outline of what looks like a fence, that's a retaining wall. It's like a 10-foot retaining wall. So when we looked at the plans for this, it really didn't show us the elevation change. And as they were being constructed, I'm like, who would want their front door to walk out and look at a 10-foot retaining wall? I thought that we should put something in there about that. If that's your front door and you're going to do, you know, shared alleyways where you have the garage is on the back side and the front side's facing a courtyard or the edge of a property, there should be an adequate setback. And also if there's a retaining wall, because that is just not a desirable unit, in my opinion, the way that that was constructed. So that's a lesson that we learned that I wanted to put into these PUD standards. Some of the other standards were building separations and facades and courtyards. So this is a lesson learned from Chesham Village. So that's up on 350 North or 3800 South. And those buildings, if you've ever walked through there, they have the driveways are accessed off of the alleys, and then the front doors are facing these courtyards. And when you walk down the courtyards, it's very confining, and they have little white picket fences that come all the way out to this really narrow sidewalk in the middle. And it just doesn't feel right. I don't know how else to explain it, but it's not aesthetically pleasing. It doesn't feel like someplace you'd want to hang out. And so when we went out with a wheel and we measured different lengths and different projects to see what felt comfortable and what worked. And we feel like we wanted to say, you know, building separation on courtyards should be 30 feet, and they should only have encroachments into that 30 feet of 5 feet. If they want to have a little fenced off front yard or area to let their dog out or something like that, then that's where the fences should be, but it shouldn't be right up to the sidewalk and make it feel like you're walking in a tunnel when you're going to those front doors.
Sherry, can I ask a question along on the lines of the building separation? So I appreciate the thoughtfulness on looking at that, and I agree. I think one of my, you know, from an aesthetic standpoint, when you go to some of these, they're just too close together for the height of the building. But I wanted to explore the relationship between what the maximum height of a building could be, particularly like in a P district, versus what the separation requirements would be. And again, you know, my own personal bias would be if they're higher, they should be set back further. You know, and as I look at it, I would say somewhere nominally, if it were 40 foot high, and I'm not sure if that would be allowed in the P district, but if it was 40 foot high, they should be at least 40 foot apart. Otherwise, it becomes that tunnel type of phenomenon
right.
you're talking about. But can we just think about what's the maximum height? Would there be limitations in a P district? Would it be the normal 30 some odd feet in most other locations?
So the difference in this would be these are standards for PUDs, but not for P district. So we do need to update the P district zone to say that these are really the guidelines for the P district zone, because that's entirely different. This is somebody who has, let's say they have R17, and it's not particular a P district, but it is a PUD. And so they can have 8 dwelling units per acre, and they're going to do 2 townhomes or I don't know, they have 5 acres, let's say. And so they can do 40 townhomes on that. And how do we cluster those townhomes? So I like that idea of increasing those distances apart based on whether they're 2-story or 3-story. So I can add something into this for that, certainly. And then I also think we need to update the P district to give more guidelines on to the Planning Commission on the design for that based on height.
Was the idea that we weren't going to have P districts if we adopted the form-based code? Will we still have it outside of that area?
We still may have it, because we have other P districts that are, like the Ridge is a P district. And they wouldn't have been affected by the form-based code for the town center. So, but we would have less P districts in the town center. We would have PUDs, but we would have less P districts in the town center once we have a town center zone. Some of the other facade or the differences were that we wanted to look at were the separation differences of the rear facades when they don't have garage access, let's say, of the backyard. So we were saying that separation should still be 30 feet. Buildings that were side to side, so where the sides of the building faced each other. Some of the walkways, when you go through Chesham Village, you still have that tunnel effect, even though they're only 2-story buildings, because the sides are so close, and then you have, you know, a sidewalk through the middle of it and barely any room on either side for landscaping. And so we wanted to put some restrictions on that, and then to 25 feet, and then have 5-foot walkways in the middle. So you would have the walkway in the middle and 10 feet of landscaping on each side of the sidewalk to the side of the building. Provide some room. Some of the things is, and as these buildings got closer and closer together, what happens was they planned on having a nice 5 or 7 feet of landscaping on both sides of the sidewalk, but then it got filled up with water meters and gas meters and air conditioners. And so it really changes the feeling of that area. It doesn't make it a pleasant place to go and be a pedestrian to get to from the parking lot or from the street to the unit. The rear setback for alley-loaded garages. So I wanted to get away from the idea of having your minimum street width for your alley or your private road, and then having the garage door right at the street. So setting those back at least 5 feet. If there weren't going to be set back for a full width of full length of a driveway, that at least they're set back 5 feet, because what that provides in that 5 feet area in between each garage on the townhome is a place for the air conditioner to go and a place for garbage cans to be stored when they're stored outside. So that was something that I thought was important and a good lesson. Also, I wanted to establish what the minimum private street width would be. So now there's nothing magic about these numbers. 26 feet of right-of-way with 24 feet of pavement. Depending, the fire district might have other requirements to have it wider, but 24 feet is really what we require in a parking lot for two-way traffic, and 24 feet felt more safer than 20 feet, as far as my perspective is. But I'm open if you feel like those numbers should be changed in any way. And let's see if I have it on the next slide. Okay, so one of the things that I've noticed come at having now living in a townhome project is that 18-foot driveways are not long enough. The minimum 18-foot that we have for a parking space in a parking lot is not long enough in a driveway because you're looking from the garage door to the street as 18 feet. Well, unless you're going to touch the garage door with the front of your car or the trucks that people own, 18 feet is not long enough. So I wanted to suggest that we make a requirement that where they are going to provide driveways, that they be 22 feet long. Because a lot of people are driving bigger trucks, or they need, you just need room to get off there and to be able to walk around your car to the door. Otherwise, you're parked right up against the door and your bumper is right out in the street and it could impede snow removal. So I'm open to a discussion on that. I don't know how developers will feel about it. They probably won't like it, but I think it'll make a nicer development. And then I wanted to establish some parking, and this is probably where we'll want to have some conversation on this. I think that we've talked a little bit that when we're looking at the parking requirements, so under our standard code, it's 2.25 per unit no matter what, whether that unit has four bedrooms or whether it has one bedroom. And so I wanted to suggest that we base those on bedroom number of bedroom counts for the units. If they're one bedroom units, I think 1 1/4 space is something that's adequate. For a two bedroom unit, 1 3/4, and for a three, anything that have three bedrooms or more, 2 2/4 spaces. The reality of today is that in these bigger units, they're having, you know, a couple families or a family that has several cars, roommates, that sort of thing. I don't claim to have any expertise in these numbers, that these are the right numbers. If you feel like we need to do more research on them, I'm happy to do that. I just thought this was a good place to start the discussion. And you don't have to decide today either if you want me to do more research on it before we have the final draft and open it up for a public hearing. I'm happy to do additional research. One of the things I wanted to put in here also was that there's required 1 covered space per unit for exclusive use and permanent use of each unit. That will prevent the unbundling of the parking and the issue we have with Eaglewood Lofts, where they rent their parking spaces separate from the apartments and the people don't want to pay for the parking spaces, so they park out on the public street. So that's one tool to help solve that problem. The other tool to help solve that problem is parking enforcement. But we have to have both, in my opinion. And so this is the one step that we can do in the code. Based on any additional reduction that that a developer may request, I think that would request it have to be done via modification. And I wanted to outline what the terms would be. So it would be based upon a parking study from a qualified firm. It would be based on the development type, the proximity to transit, the proximity to any shared parking facilities, and other unique circumstances. And it would be required a Planning Commission recommendation and a City Council approval if they wanted to get less parking approved. So, for instance, there would be a difference in a one-bedroom apartment as opposed to, say, a studio apartment, because there's some percentage where some percentage of those units are only going to have one occupant that may have only one car. When you have a one-bedroom apartment, you're more likely to have a couple, and that would have two cars. And so I think there's some things in there that can be justified. I don't know. We don't know what the future holds. We may have shared parking structures in the town center that could be on some location where they would have some availability to have other parking besides on-site parking. So I wanted to provide some of those types of conditions by which somebody could ask for a reduction, but it wouldn't be a guaranteed thing. It would have to be a legislative decision based upon the specifics of the project and the area and the property. Do you want to talk about parking?
I think there could be a discussion about would we rather have developers come in and ask for a reduction because we set the base amount maybe a little higher than we even think it could be, versus if we set it where we think it should be, and we actually want more because of the development, we have less ability to impose greater parking than let them ask for reductions in parking. So based on that, it would be all of those numbers would go up a little bit.
Possibly.
And that's kind of it's a strategy.
It is a strategy.
Of what we would want to do as a city. Because that's what I think. I would rather have applicants come in and say, well, you're requiring, you know, two for every two bedroom, but I think 1.75 is the correct number. And then it seems like we would be less hamstrung than if we put a lower number in the code.
We could always just say one per bedroom, and then they could ask for a reduction and show us a study that proved it, too.
Yeah, I am curious to know, like, if that type of data is, like, how feasible it would be to get that type of data to, like, know, I don't know how many of these situations are available in North Salt Lake now of studio versus one bedroom versus two and three, like, you know, I know
it's... Yeah, I would like to find that data. In fact, we were just discussing it last week with the city engineer. She and I sat down and we were talking about that it would be a really good intern project to go around to multifamily dwellings and knock on the doors and ask them to take a little, they could take an iPad and say, we're just doing an anonymous survey because we're trying to use an informed decision on how much parking to require in future multifamily projects. How many bedrooms do you have? How many adult drivers do you have living in your unit? And how many vehicles do you own?
Yeah, I think that's really useful information, just as a baseline, because even if we do set something, do we know really, like, if that's kind of where we want to go? And then also I was thinking, like, could we potentially, if based on studios and one bedrooms, could we potentially say, like, I mean, this also, I'm thinking about the developer who's come several times, like, to require only one only one occupant for a studio or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So some of that can come in when we're doing P districts, for sure. When we have a development agreement, it's really easy to say, enter into a development agreement that says, you have to manage your parking in this manner. You're agreeing to manage it by limiting the number of cars that your tenants own, or the number of occupants in your apartments based upon the parking restriction. I'm just not sure what that number should be, because not every person, I don't know what the statistics are. Like, if I could do a survey of a similar property that was studio apartments and there were 80 studio apartments, and I could find out that 20 of the occupants are single occupants who have zero cars, and then you've got another 30 people that are single occupants but they all own one car, and then you've got another 10 occupants that are single occupants but have two cars, and then X number, whatever the remaining is, number of units have two occupants and two cars. And I would love to find that data.
Great. I agree. Great intern project. Let's
right?
do that. Yeah.
Like, because I think to get it to be statistically accurate, we can't just put out a survey and ask people, you know, put it out on social media and say, hey, if you live in apartments, take this survey, because they're not noticing that.
No.
And they don't care.
Yeah.
Like, but if you go to them and say, look, we're not collecting your name, we're not collecting your address, we just want to know how many
numbers,
and we're marking them off on it. We went to this door, we went to this door, and then it's all collected data. And Mackenzie was talking about how she did that for a survey that she did for when she was in school, in college. It was one of her classes where they just had it in an iPad, and she would take it door to door or out on campus. And as she was doing surveys, she would just hand them the iPad and they would answer the three questions. And it takes, you know,
I'm with Commissioner Stone. I think that would be valuable. And I think
I think Councilman Knowlton with WFRC would love to spearhead that.
I think that would be a great thing for him, because I know he probably will assume that data is going to come in one way. I think the data is probably going to be in the middle of our worst fear and the optimism of the least fear. I think it's somewhere in the middle, and I just don't know where that middle is.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's dead center. I don't know if it's off to the right or off to the left a little bit. But I really feel like we need to make an informed decision when we pick these. And
I agree.
That's why I'm saying these are
just talking. I like this discussion, and I think further diligence on it's important. And I think it will depend on whether there's mature and well-adopted transit or not. And I would say, for what my perception of our community is we shouldn't be making the assumption that it's mature, well-adopted transit. People still love their cars. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that way at this point in time. I do agree with Commissioner Ward's. I would say I tried doing a Google search, and I gave up after about 10 minutes of just head spinning all over the map kind of data on this particular issue. You know, like, you know, what would be parking ratios per bedroom based on, you know, not near transit, because I thought that's where we should start. But anyway, I could come up with absolutely nothing but individual city ordinances that were all over the map.
And I think the best we could do, the best data that we would get, is people that are living in North Salt Lake right now under the conditions that we have right now. Even though we don't have bus rapid transit on Highway 89, we do have a really good ridership on the bus lines that do go through here. So we do have some data. We do know that this line gets some ridership. But to find out exactly how many cars people have, I think that would be incredibly valuable to us, if just to survey the existing apartment complexes and townhome projects that we have. And I would throw that average way off on my particular unit right at this moment, because people moved in that I didn't plan moving in. Now I have more cars than I thought I would ever have. I was planning one car and one motorcycle, and now I got a lot more. When you have a daughter and a boyfriend move in, and your own boyfriend, and then you're like, oh, and then an ex turns a car back to somebody who you didn't plan on having ever. So I'm like throwing the average off for where I live, but I think that's reality, right? Some people throw it off because of circumstances. Yeah. That circumstance will change for me and for other people, you know, as you fluctuate through cycles in your life. But finding a good average, I think that's what we need to do, is to do a survey. And I think we need to do it sooner than later, before we decide what these numbers are. So if you want to make that recommendation to us that we pursue getting that data, that would be helpful.
But we're not suggesting that staff gather the data.
Say, do you have an intern for that?
We have an engineering intern, and we have a planning intern. So
Okay. It
is a project that we could start. I think it would be a high priority, and we could start that right away. At least get some preliminary data by going through, you know, just starting at these projects along Highway 89 and moving northwards and trying to collect as much data as we can.
I
think it would be worth
it. I wholeheartedly endorse it. I think it's always better to have data than guesses.
Yep.
But I would add, take the data and then go a little bit higher.
I agree.
And let the developers convince us
to
go back down.
At least then we didn't start too low.
Yes. Philosophically, I just think we've underparked several developments in the city. And in order to avoid that, I think we start with, we want lots of parking. You convince us that you can get away with less.
Right.
And then round up.
Yeah.
And I might ask a question, too, on that survey. Do you drive a compact car? Do you drive an electric vehicle? And do you drive a truck, a full-size truck? You know, classify what kind of vehicles you have, just to give us an idea of how many people out there have trucks that don't fit in their garages. I don't know how many there are, but I know of at least three in my complex alone. I see the brand new trucks, the Ford F-50s with the cab and the long bed, and I'm like, the snowplow is never going to get by you during the winter because you're 2 feet out into the road. So I find that very interesting that people go by those and they live in smaller developments. But okay, so we will look into getting some more data on parking numbers. The next thing I wanted to address was in the PUD standards was front facades on slopes. So I have a couple of bad examples here and one good example. On the lower left-hand corner, you have the project right across the street where the individual units were stepped on the cross slope. The front doors are just above the curb elevation, so pedestrians can get in and out of them. It's appealing aesthetically. It just makes for a nicer streetscape. We look at the project on 130 East, and the doors are recessed below the sidewalk height, so they had to have a different sidewalk. They weren't stepped in elevation, and they weren't at the street level. And you can see how it's kind of awkward. And then we have the lower right-hand corner, which, again, that's the vantage point ones, where they're way above the height of the sidewalk and requires, you know, basically it's requiring two sidewalks in parallel, one 10 feet above the other. I mean, it's not quite 10 feet, but about 5 feet than the other one. And I think if we had a regulation in our PUD ordinance that said the front doors need to be at the street elevation or within a certain number of feet. And so that was what I was trying to establish in that regulation, was that front doors no lower than the curb height at the street level and no higher than 3 feet above the curb height. And then the other standards are the standards that stay the same. Lot area, width, yard, height. Lot coverage are all determined by the Planning Commission. And the requirement for free flow and air and direct sunlight. And I think that's what these other regulations achieve, is to allow the free flow of air and sunlight through these projects so it doesn't feel like you're just in a tunnel when you're walking between them. And it maintains the option for solar access.
I have a question about just looking at this one on the bottom right. What's the ADA like? What's the accessibility there?
So there are only, I think the way that it works is that there's only a certain percentage of the units that are built that actually have to be ADA
really?
Accessible. They okay. don't all have to be ADA accessible. And those can be achieved by ramps or, but not every single dwelling, because these units would not be, I mean, when multi-story isn't ADA accessible unless you put a chairlift in, right? Interior. So it's different if you're in a stacked flat apartment building, then you have to have elevators and you have to have an accessible route by wheelchair into the building. But when these are individual townhomes, they're different because they're a for sale product.
Okay.
But there should, but I like the idea of, if we're only just a few feet above the curb, it's a lot easier to put in a ramp if somebody comes later and has an accessibility issue. Or they can buy the unit that's like that.
So are the ADA requirements a federal?
They are federal.
Okay, percentage. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I bring up an issue that's not directly addressed in the standards as drafted? And I'll just start with the question. And this really applies to PUDs. I've got the same question for the condo conversions and for the mobile home parks and RV lots. So the same general question applies, and there's a reason I want to ask it, but would it be possible to have a PUD where the owner basically becomes a master meter operator for utilities? And so the ones that would most common would be like the natural gas system or the electric utilities. Would we want that? And I'll offer an opinion about that. But let me just start with, somebody comes in with a PUD and they want to, rather than have individual gas meters, which maybe they think creates a lot of clutter, they just want one gas meter. They'll run buried pipes, they'll just stub those up into the units, and then they'll allocate the bills. They can do the same thing with electricity.
I think if it were an apartment and they weren't for sale units, then they could choose to do a master meter. So it depends on the product. If they're a for sale product where they're each platted individually, then they have to have separate utilities, individual utilities. If they're doing a common project, like if you looked at Odell Crossing, so that's on the corner of Highway 89 and Odell, those are all apartments. They're townhouses, but they're owned by one entity and rented entirely. They can't be sold individually. So in that kind of a project, somebody could do that. Yes, they could do that if they wanted to include all the utilities in their rent and have one master meter.
Okay. So is that prohibited by state law or is it under city code?
It's not prohibited in an apartment. It's
no,
in
but,
that
but for like a PUD or a condo where they're individually owned, because there are existing condos that are out there that have home. So the horror story is this. I know firsthand of a condo. It was converted from apartments to condos. It has a natural gas master meter system. It's got a small board. They have no idea that they're responsible for maintaining it, blue staking it, having emergency response procedures, doing cathodic protection, doing leak surveys, any of the things that would be incumbent on a utility. And yet, you know, they're oblivious to that until either a safety issue happens or maybe a regulator happens to discover it. So I think it's undesirable from a public safety standpoint.
So you're saying on a conversion of an apartment to...
Well, anything that could end up with a master meter.
To a condo.
I mean, because again, you know, presumably right. There's a manager or a board or somebody, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that people don't understand that. And pretty soon, you know, particularly over the decades, it could become a problem. You know, pipes deteriorate, things leak, yeah. Lines can be torn out. So if, you know, you're not doing a damage prevention program or you're blue staking stuff, plumber comes in, tears the gas line out, bad things happen.
I definitely think that if they were converting a project to a condominium project, that is the place where we could put in that they would be required to reinstall separate utility meters and connections for the different units.
Yeah.
That would be a place where I would put that.
Yeah. I mean,
under the building code, if they're building them as separate units on separate permits, then each unit is already required by the building code to have its own utility connections.
Okay, good.
So if you're taking units that were started as condos and making them into apartments, there would be no change. You would still...
Okay.
They could still have their individual units. But
so
if you're
PUDs,
going from
an
apartment to a condo, then you would probably want to require some sort of change in the utilities. Now, I don't know. When I read through the condominium chapter that we have and the language that we have in code here, I've never encountered somebody that wanted to convert an apartment into a condo. I think it must have been a problem back in the 80s or 90s, I'm not sure, but I've never had a developer come and do that. The only one that I've ever had is the commercial structure across the street when Brighton came in and wanted to condominiumize the commercial building so that JF Capital could own their half of the building and Brighton would own their third of the building and JZW would own their one third of the building. So that's the only time I've ever seen a structure that was not built as a condominium get converted to a condominium, but it was a commercial condominium. So I don't know how common it would be anymore for it to happen, but I suppose there's no telling what could happen to financing and the way that, I mean, I could see something like that could possibly happen.
When we get to the condo section, and I'll try to bring it up again if I could see a spot, and then also with the mobile home and RV park, because I think there's some in that case, they clearly are maintaining that buried system. And so we need to think about what their obligations are with that, you know, not to just install it, but maybe to maintain it.
Right. I agree with that.
But if PUDs required under building code to have separate utility meters and all that, then that's a non-issue.
Yeah. I think it's a non-issue in the PUDs, but I think it could be an issue in the condos.
I would say in my former line of work, I've seen bad things happen, really bad things happen.
I I do not doubt that. I do not doubt that at all.
Sherry, I just have a question. Could you educate us, maybe, or maybe it's just me, on, I'm not, you know, fully trained in urban design, but can you tell me why the bottom right image is not as desirable?
I think that what we didn't like is it didn't have the presence on the street. So if you, we have that, we have the public sidewalk along the curb, and then we have just a wall right there. It's just a retaining wall.
And
it's about 5 feet.
Okay.
And in order to get to the unit on the end, you can't just walk from the public sidewalk up to the front door.
You have to go all the way down
and then up the end stairs.
Is there only this one access point right here?
Yes.
Would it be, is it the accessibility, or is it also the like the obstruction?
I think it's the
both
aesthetics, and it's the
okay.
I don't like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, 5
personally.
Feet is high. I'm 5 yeah. feet tall, so that would be as tall as me.
Yeah. I don't particularly like it. I don't think that it doesn't feel pedestrian friendly when you're on this public sidewalk and you have a wall right here and you have traffic right here.
Got it. Okay.
There's nothing
You've
in between
convinced
you.
Me.
I mean,
I get
if
it
you
now.
If a car went off the road onto the sidewalk, you're getting smashed between that and the wall.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Thank you.
I don't think that's the kind of urban environment that we want.
Okay.
The feeling that we have here where people could sit out on their front porch and visit with people walking by, if it actually ever happened.
Yeah,
I mean, the guy in the corner has a dog that tries to jump on me when I walk to work, but that's about the interaction that I've had with the residents that live in those units.
Was there a reason that these were built so high up, or it just was the way it came?
It was the topography, and we didn't have an ordinance that said they couldn't do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I do think the other thing that the new standard would improve on is the spacing between the buildings down that alley-loaded driveway and all that, because that's the one that seems
right.
super, super close. Yeah.
Yeah, so that one's really close between them. So the difference between, so the one on the top right, so that's the first one. That was being constructed when I started here. The problem is worse on the building that's furthest away in that than from this building that you're seeing closest in that building, and which is why the one on your lower left looks that way, because I said to Brighton, I don't want that. I want you to step each unit up the slope so that front doors come out onto the street and it makes sense. And because we're trying to have this pedestrian-oriented building and
yeah.
have it at a pedestrian scale. The one on the lower right was in an already multifamily zone, and we didn't have a standard that says you couldn't do that. And it's not that it stepped, that one isn't stepped across against a cross slope. It was just, well, we have this much slope going down into the property, and we want to have the garages coming in on the bottom level and the front doors on the second level, and the steepness of the road, it was just the topography and the way it was designed.
Got it.
But if we had more restrictions, said, well, your buildings have to be further apart and it needs to be this much further back from the street, that would have changed those topography issues, and they could have made adjustments. They wouldn't have gotten as many units in there. It would have been a better development, in my opinion.
Okay.
And
cool.
Just as a confession, the first time I drove by there and saw that gap, I cursed the Planning Commission that approved that, and then I realized that it was me and I missed it. I think we all kind
it's,
of, you know,
it is it, hard to kind of tell how high that is in the picture, so I do appreciate the measurement.
And when you see it on,
I think the other side is higher too.
It's
I think
just
this
tough.
Is the lower side. The building on this side is even a little higher
okay.
than that one. It's just, I mean, in this instant, it probably would have been better for them to have the garage could come in on the bottom level, but they could have had the third level be at the street. You could have stepped up from the garage here, you know, half step, like a half
right,
story,
yeah.
and had some sort of a living room or something in that area, because I know there's a room in that that's kind of like a basement room down by the garage. So there could have been a front door there at the street height and then stairs up to more living area on the other two stories. It would have appeared to be a two-story building. Instead, this is a two-story stacked on a half-story ground. And it's just, I don't like it.
Okay. Thank
you. It's probably my, it may just be my personal preference, but
some
people might like it.
And I'm sure the people that live in the single family home next door to it don't like it.
Right. So.
Ones that put up the no parking sign.
Okay, so those are some of the things. So some of the other things in section I that I've added into this section are the requirement to do water-efficient landscaping. That goes without saying, but I wanted a specific reference. Hey, the landscaping in a PUD has to be designed to have water-efficient landscaping. And then there's some requirements for the dedication of public spaces, like, for instance, on this particular development up at the corner of Center and Highway 89, there's some public spaces that are dedicated, the plaza space that's for permanent public access, and then easements to guarantee the permanency of those open spaces. And last thing we want is somebody come in later on and say, well, we have this really nice open space, but we want to put another building there. And so we want to put a permanency in that, that we let you cluster based on having this other usable open space cluster together, and it needs to be maintained permanently. And then common areas, area rules under the condo legislation. If it's a PUD for sale, it falls under the condo real estate laws. So that's all on PUDs. The next session is the condominium subdivision. So right now it's in its own chapter in Title 10. It's Chapter 19. Let's see. When I get to that page, I think in this document, where does it start? Oh, on page 8 of the red line document. So some of this language, or a lot of this language, is stuff that we already have in our code. There wasn't a lot of changes that I put in there other than just some of the specifics about how a condominium project would get processed. Some of the similar things that we've had about the electronic submittals. And then in section, on page 9, in section 3, where there's a conversion from the apartment complex to condominiums, there is a set of notifications that have to go out under state law. And so those are outlined here. Basically, if you're living in an apartment and the owners decide to condominiumize it, there are things that they have to do if they ask you to leave the building because they're going to sell the units, right? I think this would probably be somewhere in here where we would put that caveat on the utilities, and I have to figure out where that would be.
Yeah, I got a suggestion if it'd be helpful. Under the application requirements, just in the interest of discovery, something to the effect when you ask the age of the building and so forth, you ask about the age and condition of any buried utility lines on the property that are not owned and maintained by a public utility company. And that way would be just a way of, if there was something there like a gas system or an electric infrastructure, you would know that.
And also the service meters.
Yeah.
Including the service meters.
And I just use the term utility systems. Buried utility systems is what I'm thinking about. But, and then I think, again, when you're asking about known deficiencies regarding the buildings and so forth, you could ask about, you know, known deficiencies relative to these utility systems. And, again, it's just a way of trying to bubble up to the surface whether those things exist.
Right. And I mean, we have this section of code, so people must have done this before in places where apartments have been converted to condos. That's the whole reason we have this section. I just haven't seen it myself personally, but financing changes all the time, right? Banking and economic conditions. And so it's all cyclical, and 10 years from now, we might be seeing like Village Station wanting to be condominiumized. I don't know. It could happen. So I would suggest that we put in a requirement under the approvals. Somewhere in here that I, and I'll find the right place for it, but to put the requirement that individual require individual utilities. And I think that would address that. So again, it, you know, basically purpose and intent on the first two sections A and B. Section C are those additional requirements for notification. Section D and E talks about the review process, which is the same as a regular subdivision, and it does identify some additional review criteria in there. Section F through I have the Planning Commission review and the specific findings that have to be made to approve it. Sections J and K talks about the special notice that has to go out to the tenants of the building prior to or when it's finally approved. And it provides a protest and investigation for those tenants who feel like they were not treated fairly in being evicted so that their apartment could be sold out from their residency. Any questions on that section? My idea is that I think it probably will be used very rarely, but I can't say what time will tell. The next section is the mobile home parks and the mobile home subdivisions and recreational vehicle parks. So these are a section that we already have in place. I don't foresee that we would ever have a new mobile home park come in somewhere, but I could see somebody buys vacant land near the existing mobile home park, particularly Colonial Village, and wanted to expand it. And if they wanted to expand it, then these rules are what would govern. Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting here as I read through some of the regulations that we have in here, I liked, when I was reading that, I was like, 7 dwelling units per acre. And I was wondering, how many dwelling units per acre are in our two mobile home parks? Do you have a guess? So, right, like it feels like that, right? So Camelot is actually at like 7.25 for the number of acres they have. And Colonial Woods is at like 11. So they're way, way more dense and tight packed into that, into the one on off of 1100 North. But I was really surprised that that's what 7 dwelling units, 7 mobile homes look per acre. Yeah. It's just when you look at it and that with all the little landscaping pockets and the streets, and because it wasn't 7 acres on the net, it's 7 acres on the gross. So the streets count as that, towards that density calculation, the way this was built in how many years and years ago. But if you drive through those two projects, you can see what the difference is between one that's maintained better than the other. And I don't think I need to say which one it is, but you can see just in some, I've noticed some of the realtor ads for some of the units that are being sold in in Camelot. Some of them have been really remodeled quite nicely, and it's really a good section of affordable housing that we have in the city. So anyway, those are the standards that are written in there. I have put in some updates for just language, like when it talks about recreational coaches, changing that to recreational vehicles. A couple of the things that are a little bit crazy is the standard that we have in the code right now that the building inspector is supposed to inspect every mobile home once a year. So there are 450 of them. He'd be doing 3 a day every workday that he worked if that were just to stay on top of that requirement. So I don't know how long that hasn't been done or if it was ever done, but I feel like that needs to be taken out. We do inspections on them as requested when they have building permits or when we've done home improvement grants in there. We've had inspections done for health and safety or when we have complaints that something is not up to livable standards. So some of the other things that are in there are, you know, are about how the mobile homes are attached to the, you know, to the how they're held down. And that's all per the building code. And then just kind of updating that language in there for the guarantees on providing the adequate retention of the permanent open spaces or the landscaping areas. It has a requirement right now for a cash deposit. I can't even imagine how much that cash deposit would have been 50 years ago when this park was put in, or what it would exactly, who would be holding it today, I don't know. And how far it would go, because I would imagine it wouldn't go very far with today's. And so I think a better requirements are that they have some sort of CCNRs and operation plans, HOA management entity that sets up the funds that create their operating expenses and cover their expenses to, you know, repave their roads and take care of their swimming pool and, you know, deal with their streetlights, because all of the infrastructure that are inside of the mobile home park is owned and operated by the owner of the mobile home park. So we do not operate them. We do not pave the streets. We do not own the water lines that are in there at all. So those are all owned by the
operator. So, Sherry, to that end, there's a section on underground utilities under standards part D3-4.
What page is that on?
I'm on the clean copy, so.
Okay.
But anyway, it's titled Utilities Underground. And it says every mobile home park, recreational vehicle park, and mobile home subdivision shall provide underground utility service to every mobile home stand or lot. Anyway, again, I would want it to be provide and maintain. And then I wanted to ask.
Can you just tell me what line number that's on? Because I
have. Okay, 478.
478. Okay, that helps me.
Actually, on 479, says shall provide. I just want to get the sense of long-term responsibility with that, provide okay. And maintain. And then the
provide
last three items,
maintain.
I wanted to ask about those because it specifies natural gas, telephone, and television. Telephone and television become blurred as telecommunications, so I don't know if we want to actually list them separately. And then the other point is natural gas is not normally a commodity that's served to a recreational vehicle park. It's water, power, and sewer, and that's all.
Right, that one's just for mobile homes.
But I think television, in my mind, telephone and television kind of merge together in this day and age to telecommunications.
And then that also includes internet, too, so.
Right.
So if we change that to telecommunications.
Yeah, and then maybe strike natural gas.
Yeah, because that is, I mean, they can have electric heat, too, so. Okay. So that was section D where we had the standards for required facilities.
Sorry, I have a question about
yeah
the mobile home and RV parks area. So I see at the bottom standard for I'm thinking of something. So are there requirements for green space and like that kind of thing, or is that not indicated, or is that just at the discretion of the owner?
So down on the next page, if you're on the clean version on line 51 or 571, residential accommodation, not less than 10% of the gross land area shall be set aside for passive recreational accommodations.
Oh, yeah.
And they cannot count the roads, sidewalks, or off-street parking in that 10% of common area. Does Does that address that? Okay. And that's it on that I have for Chapter 6. If you don't have any additional comments on any of that. Okay. So we can talk about Chapter 7, which is plat amendments. All right, so this is a lot of the existing language from 1077 Section H. So the first section, A, just tells about the application and the requirements for the submittal, updates some of that language, so it's electronic submittal, that type of thing that we've done throughout the rest of the subdivision stuff. There is a specific requirement when you are vacating a public utility public utility easement or a public right-of-way that requires a public hearing, and it will take action by the city council. So one of the requirements for that type of plat amendment would require envelopes and to be submitted for the property owners within 300 feet of the boundary or those people that are directly affected by the public utility easement or right-of-way vacation. So the review process would be processed regularly if they're just an uncontested plat amendment, would not require a public hearing, wouldn't create any additional lots in the subdivision, so it's just a standard. We're moving the lot line between two platted lots, and that would be something that would be routine and uncontested, would come to the Planning Commission for a plat amendment. Again, then if it's moving the public utility easement or a street, only the City Council can approve the vacation of those and the amendments to those, so those would have to go to the City Council still. The standards for approval are basically outlined, you know, that there's not any required installation of additional improvements. It's already existing. No new parcel is created. If the Planning Commission for some reason denied approval of a plat amendment, there's an appeal procedure where somebody could appeal it to the City Council. And then the Section 20 gets into what's exempted from having to do a plat amendment. If somebody just does a simple lot line or boundary line agreement, this is something that we already handle today administratively. So they file an application with my office. The planning department reviews it, the engineering department reviews it. So this would be if two property owners had a fence line that had been in a specific location for 15 years, and they had a survey done and they found out, oh, my property line's actually 2 feet into your property, but we're going to agree that the property line is where the fence is. And so that's pretty routine and uncontested. The two property owners agree to sign a boundary line agreement, but we review it in by the engineer and planning just to make sure that it doesn't create a problem where one lot now is lower than the minimum lot size or has less frontage than is required by the code. So that's what we're reviewing there. If they were denied a lot line adjustment by staff, the applicant would have the ability to appeal that to the Planning Commission for review if they felt like we had made that in error. There it goes into what kind of recordable instrument they would have for the lot line adjustment. We provide them with a signed application certifying that we reviewed it as the city and that there's no violation to our code by approving that. And that's all of that section. Any question on plat amendments or lot line adjustments? Good stuff, huh? Okay. So here's our schedule. Next time we'll be doing the general requirements for subdivision and then essential improvements the week after that, the meeting after that. And don't forget there are 5 Tuesdays in October. So there'll be 3 weeks in between our last meeting in October and our first meeting in November. And I don't have any action updates. We didn't have any items go to City Council last week, so there were nothing to report.
Turn my mic. Let's approve the minutes for September 26th meeting. Any corrections or comments?
One small edit on line 138. I think there's some extra words in there. If we strike as it was, I think that would clarify the what Commissioner Holbrook said, unless he wants to further clarify a statement. I work really hard to find something.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good catch.
Well, at the end I was, because I learned that it was existing.
You're okay with the existing gravel, yeah. So I think striking those three words clarifies that. Yeah. And with that, I'm prepared to offer a motion. So Commissioner Jorgensen, offer a motion to approve the meeting minutes for the September 25th, 2023 Planning Commission meeting as drafted with the one edit on line 138.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 I think the meeting is adjourned.
We did it.